Hey guys, this is Nicole, and happy end of the circuit breaker! Welcome back to the Singapod. This is episode 2. This week we'll be talking about the controversy over this year's NDP fun pack and the taxi driver that was sentenced to 4 months of jail for spreading false information about supermarkets and food centres during the circuit breaker. At the end of the podcast, we're also going to be speaking to Amanda Woon of the Maju Collective about the state of food security in Singapore. Stay tuned to the Singapod. Now with our new theme music.
Welcome to the Singapore. Pursuant to Section 49, Subsection 7E, Paragraph A.
Because nobody, no group of men have got the will, have got the capacity to do more for this country.
Everything
that's what is different about Singapore.
So it was announced that this year's National Day Parade would not be held in a single location like the Padang National Stadium or the Marina Bay Float for the first time since Singapore's independence in 1965. So the planning committee announced that they want to give NDP fun packs to 1.2 million Singaporean and PR households to join in the celebrations from their own home as well. In the last week, we've seen some pushback against this move. Concerns have been raised about the sustainability and purpose of this. There's even been a petition that's been set up calling citizens to express their desire to opt out of receiving this year's fun pack.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. These petitioners, they brought up quite a few reasons why they wanted to opt out of receiving this year's fun pack. I think there's a lot of anxiety right now about COVID-19, about a recession, and about the economic pain that Singaporeans are about to see. But I think some people don't realise that NDP is just 3 months away, so I think a lot of these fun packs were probably already created for the people that were going to go and watch the rehearsals and the main parade itself in August. So I definitely can understand where these petitioners are coming from. I think they would want their fun pack to be given to somebody who wants it or who needs it more. But I think to ask the planning committee to redirect these resources to something more pressing is a bit difficult because a lot of these items are actually given or sponsored by various companies. So there isn't really any proper monetary resource to be redirected. But they do bring up very interesting arguments about the sustainability of the fun pack. I mean, we've seen lots of single-use plastics and lots of novelty items like lights, like clappers, like visors, fans. And I think it's quite important to talk about the sustainability and eco-friendliness of these fun packs as we move forward.
So yeah, I fully agree with you right there. You know, you talked about sponsors, you talked about novelty items, but if we trace the roots of the fun pack and bring it all the way back to 1991, you know, the first year that we seen the fun pack at the NDP, and it was implemented as a survival kit for participants and audience members. They had to sit in the rain, they had to sit in the sun, and the organizers thought it would be great to pass them a goodie bag, as it was called back then, for them, you know, with ponchos, with caps, fans, and stuff just to keep them going throughout the parade. But as the years went by, we've seen the evolution of the pack in the sense where we've seen more items put in. We've seen lights, banners, noisemakers, even coupon books. And it's really become part of our national identity and part of national culture as Singaporeans.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's definitely something that I can like very clearly remember. I remember when we went for our NA show in 2007, like that year, the fun pack was, there were like 6 different colors.
Yeah.
And you could remove the zips and like interchange the colors together. And they kind of resembled like the crumpler bag, which like was like, I don't know, I remember it being like the coolest thing at the time. Like everyone wanted one. And it was funny that NDP like recreated that design that year.
Yeah, and I remember that so vividly. And fun fact about that is that fun pack for the year 2007 actually contained the most number of items ever put into a fun pack at 28 items. So these bags really bring back a personal sense of nostalgia in me. And I think that's exactly what the organizers were going for. But these petitioners do bring up important points. And I think it's important moving forward to see how we can continue this practice and continue this tradition in a sustainable and responsible way.
So another big story this week was about the taxi driver that received 4 months of jail for posting false information about the closure of supermarkets and food outlets.
In April, he posted on a Taxi Uncle Facebook group that food courts and coffee shops were all going to be closed and that supermarkets would only be open for 2 days a week. And he encouraged the members of the Facebook group to go and stock up on their supermarket items for the next month or so. So the information that he put in his post was deemed to be false, and he pled guilty to transmitting a false message under the Miscellaneous Offences Public Order and Nuisance Act. And I think 4 months of jail is, I mean, definitely quite a lot. And his post was only up for 15 minutes. But I think it seems that the courts wanted to make a larger point about spreading false information, especially about supermarkets and food places.
So yeah, I think we can really see how remorseful he was for his actions. If we look at his statements, it's really quite sad, the state that he's in. But this really goes to show how seriously the judge and the government is actually taking this matter. I think the judge here, she's saying that spreading false messages like that will lead to panic buying. And if we look back to February at the start of the pandemic here in Singapore, you know, back then we saw a lot of panic buying. We saw supermarkets being wiped out. And I guess she's referring to that and saying that we don't want to go back into that state again.
Yeah, so I think the panic buying that we saw in February was something that a lot of us had never experienced before. I think it was very jarring for a lot of people to see their supermarket shelves empty. And a lot of things that we're used to seeing in abundance were suddenly all gone. And so I think the government went to great lengths to try and reassure the public that we had enough food, that they had stockpiles, and to discourage people from buying more than what they needed. But I think the whole pandemic has really brought up questions about where Singapore's food supply comes from, especially when global supply chains are being disrupted. I think a lot of people are wondering whether our system is durable enough to withstand another crisis like this, or maybe a crisis that's even worse. So joining us today is Amanda Woon, co-founder of the Maju Collective. So Amanda, can you tell us a bit more about, I guess, what the Maju Collective is and what you guys do around the area of food security?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the Maju Collective is actually a social enterprise. And we look at social, environmental, and planetary health issues thematically to work with stakeholders within these ecosystems. So from industries to NGOs to activists, ground-up communities and all that. In that process also to foster that collaboration within the ecosystem. By looking at the systemic gap that exists, we work with educators and the stakeholders within these ecosystems to bring these topics into the classroom, and not through like an educational like program kind of way, but to build a platform where educators can access these information and incorporate what we call like real world issues into the classroom. So since last year, actually, we've been diving into the food system space, anything from farm to fork, and it's a really, really like very complex issue. With that, we actually worked and held like events together with stakeholders from agri-tech to permaculture to aquasystems to be able to understand what they saw as issues within their space and to understand how young people and the future and the next generation can come into play to address the issues that they see within an environmental context, but also within a social framing of understanding things like food security as well.
So Amanda, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what the term food security actually means and why Singaporeans should think about it more.
By definition, by the United Nations, food security is defined as that it means that all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their food preferences and dietary needs for an active and healthy lifestyle. It's a very loaded term. I think if I could break it down, it just really means whether or not people get food that they want and need for them to live in a way that is sustainable and are healthy enough for them to survive. And why it matters to us is because, firstly, the way that we are as a country, we rely heavily on brain resources in a way. We don't really look at agriculture export as part of our GDP process. At this juncture, actually, we are about only 10% self-sustaining. So only 90% of our food is actually imported from overseas. And it's very ironic because even though we're 90% dependent on our imports, we are actually rated to be one of the top, if not the top, food secure countries in the world. The reason being because Singapore has a lot of means of diversifying our strategies in understanding food systems. So I think if it's anything at all, one of the things that really raised the issue of food security was the the whole panic buying period, I'm sure everyone remembers that, when everyone just flocked to the markets because everyone was just like, oh no, there's not enough food for us, so we just got to go and like get what we need to protect our families first. What happened after that was that the government actually showed the whole stockpile of what we had and reassured everyone that we're food secure. We've got the shit together, you know, we don't have to be too concerned about everything. But what we've also realized during COVID as a global pandemic was that at the end of the day, most countries want to protect themselves. But when something hits the whole world at one scale, what do we have? We have 10% of our food grown locally. That is the only certainty that we have apart from the dependencies on perhaps maybe the closer relationships with Southeast Asia. So why Singaporeans should care? I think it comes down to the simple fact that, you know, if there's no farmers, there are no food. And if there's no food, then we cannot survive. The issue about food security, it seems very far away because we live in like a food paradise. People come to Singapore to eat, you know what I mean? And food is always something that we see as is always present. But when you look at the reality of where food comes from, not just what's in the hawker, there are a lot of more things that are intertwined with that affect the security of where we are and where we'll be heading to in the uncertainty of like the years to come as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess, you know, if Singapore doesn't really grow our own food, can you explain a little bit more about the strategies that we take to make sure that Singaporeans get the food that they need?
If I could go back a bit into the history of food security, Singapore used to be an agricultural space. Many years ago, we had about more than 2,000 farms. And it's very evident in actually the way we name our road. So like Orchard Road, for one, used to be an orchard. But because of the limited land size and the growing population and the direction with progress that we made, a lot of these farms started to be taken away. Right now, from the over 2,000 farms that we used to have, we currently have maybe about 100 to 200 farms. So that's a really big cut, firstly, in terms of the food production that Singapore has. So last year, actually, about the same time that we were looking into understanding food systems, the government brought up the whole 30 by 30 campaign. I don't know if it's something that is very well talked about, but within the food system space, it's a really, really big issue. So by 30 by 30 direction is actually the goal of producing 30% of Singapore's nutritional needs within a local space by 2030. So we have the stock. Like, you know how in Singapore, there's always like a narrative to anything when I study. Like, there used to be the three steps, you know, that we study in social studies. Yeah. Right now, it's the three food baskets. Always in threes, I don't know why. So the three food baskets come from things like supporting local produce, diversifying our imports, and growing overseas. So because of all the strategies and the kind of bilateral relationships that our government has with the world, we are generally food secure. So the heart of having all these diversification strategies in a general state of any point of time is always very safe, because if any country that we rely on our food has a war or a environmental issue that happens to them, we still have hundreds of other countries that we can look to get food from.
So, Amanda, I think when most people in Singapore think of farming, like, we usually think of large sprawling plantations, you know, and that the work is really, really tiring, right? And it's not a world that many people get to see. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what farming actually looks like in Singapore, and maybe how it's changing and how it's evolving.
Okay, so if you're looking at all the different types of produce we have poultry, so like chicken, eggs, we have fish, we have dairy farms, we have vegetable farms. These are the four bigger categories. Most, if not all, the farmers that we speak to, and in Singapore, I think across the world actually, farmers are typically above 60. Recently, I think there's been a bit more people who are stepping into agriculture and agri-tech as well. And when, it's quite funny, when we were having one of the school programs, we actually invited a young farmer, one of the people from Singapore Young Farmers, down to our school program. And in the feedback, he was saying that, you asked like, you know, like, what is something that changed for you? What do you learn? And he said that he always thought that farmers were smelly old men who wear straw hats and sweat a lot. But now he's like, I didn't know farmers could be so cool and like young and hip. And after that, he went, like, for the rest of the month, he started, like, thinking, he started growing his own ginger roots, started growing his own plants, and trying to see and understand and connect himself with the land. And I think one of the things that issue taught us was also really about the discrepancy in understanding where our food comes from and the people that grow the food. So the question on you know, what is really the history and nature of farming within Singapore, and what does it mean for our country? I think a lot of it relies on how much we choose to learn about it. Every farmer right now that I know works hard so that their children don't become farmers, so that their children don't end up having to take up the rake and work and toil under the sun, because it is hard work. But the introduction of things like indoor farming, agri-tech, allows us to see farming in a different light. Singapore's position, again, is always about being a hub for, like, innovation, for technology, for growth within Southeast Asia. And by and large, that is why we work very closely with things like venture capitals to produce or to look at innovations within the food space, where it's really not just some back-breaking process, but to see farming as something that is progressive, that is needed, that is actually a part of a greater good than yourself.
Yeah, definitely. So Amanda, you also mentioned about the panic buying that we saw earlier in the pandemic. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on the vulnerable populations in Singapore, especially when it comes to food security.
Wow, so it's a bit hard to group them in any particular way. But I think one of the things that came out, at least in the media, was about people who needed food that people were taking. So things like non-perishables, like your Maggi Mee and all that, people who live on that. So I was supporting one of the families recently, and one of the things she said was, just get me a lot of canned food because my kids love it. It's tasty for them. It's simple for me to cook, requires the least amount of time. And it just can be stored for a longer time. So if I need it, I can just take it out. And it's enough. It's enough to fill their tummies. The question is whether it's actually nutritional for their children's benefit. She had three children. All three of them, and they were all under five, all three of them had issues from UTI to heart issues. And yeah, I think it just really reflects the reality of how we see food as firstly something that fills our tummies, but also that we typically tend to forget that at the end of the day, filling our tummy is not the end goal. It's about providing our body what it needs. So there are the people that live in circumstances where they just don't have enough to buy or purchase nutritional quality food. So when the pandemic struck, I think there were quite a bit of like media cries, I guess, against the people who were stockpiling things like Maggi Mee and instant noodles, canned food and things that were non-perishable. Because the people who are typically food insecure, and it's not really a term, but people who are more vulnerable to food security issues, typically rely on these kind of resources for their nutritional intake. And in general, these populations, these communities rely on organizations that support them through food distribution.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've really seen multiple organizations step up during this pandemic to make sure that people are getting the help that they need, right? And Amanda, you've been so helpful in helping us understand more about food security here in Singapore. And I guess to end off, what advice would you give to people who, you know, want to affect change in this space?
Yeah. So I think, yeah, it could be just three things, and I just put it out in a three-point thing. So the first one would be to think about what you're giving and who you're giving it to a lot more intentionally. The second would be to think about ways that you can find simple solutions to bigger issues from the ground up, from your own communities. And the third thing, would just be sit down and to know the people that you want to help, as opposed to assuming that you're helping them just because you're giving money or giving something. It's very easy for us to be like, you know, sitting down, like scrolling Facebook, or like, oh no, so poor thing, I don't know what I can do, let me give money. Because money is the best, easiest thing, it requires the least amount of effort. But the reality of how typical donations kind of work is that you kind of meet an immediate need, as opposed to understanding the systemic gap and the root of all of it altogether. So you meet a need on the surface, but you don't actually tackle the root at the bottom. And the beauty of a ground-up initiative is that because it is started within the community, within any small community at all, the impacts are a lot more long-lasting because they have greater ownership of it. And ownership is a very big thing when you're looking at change. So I think one of the things we can do, we don't have to think about how to change the world and like resolve food hunger. No, it's just about how do I put a simple solution that allows the biggest amount of change? I think on a more personal level of what people can do, very often we used to have, I think everyone kind of grew up with having the opportunity to donate food. There are always food donation drives. I think one of the very simple things that we can do is to really think firstly about who we're giving it to. It's a very simple thought to have. Who am I giving it to? Is it a young person? Is it a senior? Is it an elderly? What are their needs? And to think about that and to donate the food likewise. And at the same time, to not treat it as a garbage. It is not a place for us to throw things that we don't want or don't need or is expired especially. And it's really gross because a lot of the food banks actually receive food that are like spilling out of their cans. It's a really ugly side of some people, I guess. But I mean, to look at the good side is that there's really a lot of donations coming in. And the reality is that Singapore is a very privileged society and we exist in a state of abundance.
Yeah, we really do. And I really hope that anyone who does have the means can find a way to help. Thank you so much, Amanda, for coming on the podcast this week. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for sticking around till the end of another episode of The Singapod. We hope you enjoyed it. If you have any topics you'd like us to cover, or if you want to join us on the podcast, drop us an email at thesingapod@gmail.com. We'll see you guys next week.